So pretty soon we pulled up there on number 17. We're on 17, the Fulton Road. And he stops, and right by the door, and Robbie says, "Ainsworth, here's where you get off." I said, "God," I said, "it looks kind of bad, don't it?" And so I slid those tanks out into the snow about 6 foot deep there. And I took my stuff and jumped out into it and went in clear to my chin in the snow. And well, I was kind of burnt up because they told me the crew would be there to help me, see.
Were you alone? No one else there?
I was there all alone. Nobody else there. In the canyon here, 10 below zero. And snow, of course, the cold didn't bother me much then. But anyway, I seen that there was a phone box right close there, so I called Mr. Guile up and told him. And I said, "Just what do you want me to do? Do you want me to go ahead and do the best I can here?" I said, "There isn't any crew here to help me." I said, "This thing is, when they backed it out of the, off of the bridge there, well, they just got a pack full of snow. It's got to be dug out." And I says, "I don't know what I can do alone." "Well," he says, "that's too bad." He says, "Vern," but he says, "you just do the best you can." He says, "and if we have to wait a while to load it when the crew gets in there from Pendleton, why, it'll be all right." So I went back and got up in the dozer and got me organized, and there's lots of shovels there. So I had to shovel the snow for about a couple hours. And after a couple hours and a half of shoveling snow, I had the dozer shoveled out and a big spot shoveled out where I could set up my tanks and go to work on this dozer, cutting it loose.
What were you cutting it loose from, Dad?
Well, the dozer part of it is a frame that goes up and down. It operates up and down on the outside.
Uh-huh.
And then it operates by air, and the big arms goes in like this, knuckled arms, and you can go down a siding and pick all the snow off of here and throw it off down over into the canyon.
I see.
One side or the other, or you can use both sides, see,
mm-hmm.
and use it as just a regular pointed plow. Well, I went to cutting, and everything, and a freight train or two passed, and everything went along all right. And I was getting down in there, and of course the heat from the acetylene torch soon melted a lot of that snow down underneath there, you know. And I'd get to those braces, and I cut the braces off close enough under that you could take them into the blacksmith shop and make a re-roll on them, and that's all you'd have to do. And you had to cut them off so as they wouldn't hang down when the dozer was put into a train.
Mm-hmm.
So I got the, was getting along fine, just fine. I had one side completely ready to go, and part of the other side, and was up to the nose. That's up where the coupling is at the front of this dozer. And, where this coupling is on the front end of the dozer, why, I couldn't reach it, so I had to get up there and stand on the head with my feet in the air and crawl down in here with my feet up in the air to cut off a couple of front end braces. And about the time I got them braces cut off, I heard the biggest roar coming, and it just sounded like all hell was roaring down through the canyon there that night, and 10 below zero, and just as clear as a bell and still, you know. And to see a bobcat occasionally, and this and that and the other, roaming around out there with their eyes shining. And I knew it was number 5, the mail train. Hot shot stuff, you know. Wilson, I went to get out of that. already.
So you got to pray you were, telling you were found, you were hooked on that lever there.
So the time I got out, unhooked off of this lever and got out, well, the mail trainer went by, and this was Red QZ there, which is an engineer just dashing running past the Red QZ, you know. That's against all rules and regulations. Of course, I knew that too. However, why, he just poof, 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 with a whistle and applied the brakes, and you never saw a scene in your life that was equal at that, with the sparks and the hot metal flying off of those wheels. Just lit up that whole canyon on both sides. A picture of it would be something to look at.
You really hit those brakes, huh?
Yeah. Well, of course, I thought, well, I'm in bad. I may have a lot of flat spots on that train. They may have to cut them out or limp into Pendleton and transfer everything. So, self-preservation being the law of nature, why, I don't know why it come to me right quick. But I grabbed this Red QZ and run around to the other side of the dozer, and I stuck it way back in the snow just as far as I could. And then I lit my torch and I laid it down and cut the oxygen down a little. And here the little red sparks was flying off of this. And this engineer, he backed up to the thing and he looked at that. He said, "What's the idea of the Red QZ?" "What do you mean, Red QZ?" I said. And I said, "I got nothing here but a acetylene torch. If you can't tell the difference between a Red QZ and a acetylene torch, well, you better get into Dr. Booby and have your eyes tested." And we argued for a minute or two there, and I said, "The best thing you can do, mister, is get the hell out of here with that train, or you're going to be in bad." And I said, "I suggest you have your eyes tested when you get back into the ground." And he pooped and went where the train went. So, the wrecker with Mr. Tull on it, he was chloroformed and then at the reef. He came in the next morning to pick it up, got there about 3:30, and I had it all ready to pick up and put on the flat car. And then I went in and I took care of my stuff for me and the gas and everything. And I went in and the cook in there fixed me a nice big breakfast, and then I crawled in the sack. And he woke me up at 7:30, was back in the Grand, ready to go to work.
Did you ever hear any more from train full of flat wheels?
No. Anyway, the next morning, I went right to work then to the shop. I didn't go home. I had my sleep and a good feed. And so I went to work, and I got to thinking about 10 o'clock. Well, I suppose when that fellow makes a case of this, that was a Red QZ. And he gets me into a jam over it. So I told the board woman about her, Frank Wilhelm, and I says, "I believe I ought to go across and if I can get a little Mr. Dial and give him a picture of the thing so if this thing comes up, because Dial would have be in direct charge of the train man and engine man." And Frank says, "Maybe you better go up." And so I got a hold of Mr. Guile, the superintendent, and asked if he could give me a few minutes of his time, that I had something very important to discuss with him from last night. "Sure, come right over, Vern." So I went over and I told him the story about the Red QZ. I never saw a superintendent of a railroad laugh so much in my life. And 10 days later, he called me up and told me that he'd never heard a word about the Red QZ from the engine man. So that kind of ended that episode. Stop at number five.
Yeah. You were going to tell me about the night in Huntington, Dad.
Well, that's a pretty long story.
Mm-hmm.
I'm getting tired.
Oh, yeah? All right, we'll do it another time.
We'll do it another time. We'll do it tomorrow.
Okay.
Tell us about that bad night at Huntington, Dad, right?
Yeah, I thought that would be kind of interesting to remember.
This is October the 17th,
1972. 16th.
Yesterday was the 16th.
What?
Right?
Well, that's
what you told me. I made an official document of that.
Well, we'll have to make this together then. Well, I think maybe I told you wrong. I don't know. Don't make much difference. For one day.
Okay, Daddy.
Is this thing here pointed right to me?
Yeah. Good business there.
Well, I thought it'd be kind of interesting, Merrill, to know what really transpired and what happened during the Great Depression of 1929 to about 1937. The worst period was from 1929 to 1933. And the Union Pacific, along with every other big corporation or railroads, were in an awful financial stress for no business. People lost their homes, their bank accounts, and everything, including me. So the Union Pacific was fighting to keep things in operation. And so in 1931, in October, they decided to readjust their operation to curtail expenses. So they moved the work from Huntington, or from La Grande, to Huntington. And along with that, they moved your old dad.
Made it a division point there instead of La Grande?
Yeah, made it a maintenance point instead of La Grande.
I see.
And La Grande wasn't doing any of the work on the engines.
Mm-hmm.
They were running from Huntington to Reef, right through La Grande.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to Huntington and took 9 boilermakers and helpers and 2 sets of boiler washers to Huntington so we could wash boilers on a 24-hour basis down there.
Mm-hmm.
And the first year at Huntington, I worked days as boiler foreman. And then she kept getting tighter and tighter and tighter. And so in October 1932, they abolished the night foreman's job in Huntington and assigned those duties to the boiler foreman. So the boiler foreman, he went on nights.
Mm-hmm.
And everything went along pretty good. We were only running about 2 freight trains east and 2 freight trains west a day besides the passenger trains and the mail train.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm leading up to this story of this worst night that I believe I ever spent in my life. The foreman in those days worked 12-hour shifts, and you're usually turning your work over to your other foreman lineup while you generally put in about 12 and a half to 13 hours a day. And Union Pacific's a hell of a good place to work, but they didn't have any respect for young human flesh, if you could take it. and you had to be tough to take it. So this night in particular was a novel storm and wind and snow, and it was 10 below zero when I went to work about 7 p.m. as usual. About 6:30 usually I would go to work. And you can't imagine on the freight trains the poor fellows that came through Huntington stranded, hungry and cold, with nothing to eat. And so we set up a kind of a relief program. I operated the program, and Senator King would collect money, 50 cents or a dollar or 2 bits here and there from the engineers and firemen and trainmen, and turn the money over to me. And I wouldn't give these 400 fellows the money, but I had a little yellow pad that I would write to and okay them to take this across to a little restaurant. I can't remember that fellow's name that run the restaurant there at Huntington, a great big fellow.
Howell?
No, it wasn't Howell. Howell's came in a little later. But he was an awful nice fellow, and so we lined up with him, and I would write them an order to go over, and they could have all the hot cakes and a couple of eggs and coffee, all they could drink, and all the hot cakes they could eat for 2 bits. And if they wanted a couple of big bowls of soup and crackers and coffee, hot soup, and this fellow that run the restaurant done a wonderful job of making this big pot of stew and soup. And you could go in there for 15 cents and have all that you could eat, good hot stuff coming in there on them cold trains, and crackers and coffee. And it worked out pretty good that way. I suppose we spent around $7 or $8 every night on that program.
Is that right?
Yeah. So this particular night I came to work as usual, as I previously mentioned, and it was terribly cold, Merle. It was 10 below zero. We had thermometers up, you know, over in the roundhouse and outside and around so we could know how cold it was. And it was 10 below on the 40-mile wind blowing, and the sagebrush being broke off, and the sand and the dirt and the snow was blowing in through there. You could hardly stand up against it at times. So I had the Portland Rose that was due in at 9:10. So I set the engine out, 3216. She was to cut in on there to go east at Huntington. The 5407 brought the train in that night, 11 cars, loaded to the gads with people who were all asleep, and a couple of day coaches for them to ride in. So we set this 3216 out, and I called an extra hostler that night because I wasn't going to set an engine out without somebody on there to see that all the heaters, injectors, feed water pumps, steam heat, and everything was in operation.
Mm-hmm. Why that? For that freeze up, you mean?
Right. For afraid they would freeze up. And so Val Huffman, a hostler, our regular hostler, he went out and took the 3216 out. She was a coal burner. Everything was burning coal at that time, east of Huntington.
This was before the days of oil burners.
Yeah, we had oil burners only from La Grande to Portland.
Mm-hmm.
And I instructed him to stay there and instruct the engine man about the heater, be sure that they were left on because it was terribly cold. Of course, you have steam heat in the cabs of these engines, and it's nice and comfortable in there, temperature around 75 or 80. So, what does Mr. Engineer do but turn off the steam heat? And unbeknownst to me, when the train pulled in, we cut the 54-7 off and put the 32-16 on the train, and we couldn't get any steam heat to all these cars. And it would be a disaster if we couldn't get the steam heat through. So I kept the 5407 standing by always on a night like that, just in case that I had to cut the engine off, put another engine on to keep the train warm. Because 200 or 300 people sleeping in there and 10 below zero, and that wind blowing, boy, she was tough. I had a big old sheepskin coat on, turned up around, and a cap on, gloves, two pair of gloves, and my long jeans, and wool pants, and brother, I want to tell you, you needed every bit of clothes you had. Well, we backed the 3216 in on the train, and we couldn't get no steam heat through. So we fussed around for a few minutes, and a fellow by the name of Birch, who was lead carman on the second shift, he says, "I know what's the matter." And we always kept waste, oily waste, and a big long rod arrangement that you could put all the waste on and clamp it on there and light it to thaw out any pipe. Mm-hmm. So he stuck this oily waste under the cab of the engine, and sure enough, why, he broke that pipe loose and the steam comes through, and about that time the engineer and the fireman come out of the cab. And so I told him, "Get back in there and take it." And what I should have done is fired both of them and called another crew. But I didn't, because I was afraid to create unnecessary delay. So, boy, I'll tell you, it was a pleasure to me when I could see those spiller valves open up on that train and the steam line going through that train. Because it would add, if you froze the train up there and busted all those pipes, those coaches would have been tied up for weeks before they could have been put back in service.
Yeah.
Well, we finally got him all the steam heat through and everything in operation, and the train pulled out, and so I started back to the roundhouse office, and as I was going by the rip track, went by the rip track, which was normal way to go back to the roundhouse, why, I went by a boxcar, the door was open about 6 inches, and I thought I heard a little baby cry. I said, "Oh, good Lord, no, that can't be right on a night like this." However, I stood there, and sure enough, I could hear that little baby cry.
I'll be there.
And never makes me cry to think about it. What would have happened if I hadn't have got a hold of that little family. But I put the boxcar over and throwed my flashlight in there. I always carried a good 3-cell flashlight, focuses, throw a light for 100 or 200 feet.
Yeah, I remember that.
And here in one corner of the boxcar were about three or four old blankets covered with coal dirt and everything. Was a bunch of little kids and a man and his wife curled up together there to try to keep warm. Mm. So I asked the man, I says, what are you doing here? Well, he says, I'm trying to get to Portland. He says, if I can get to Portland, he says, I'll be all right. He says, I've got a brother there that's expecting me. Well, I says, man, I says, you can't stay in here tonight. I says, this car I noticed on the building is cut out for wheels. She'll be here for a couple of days. And the thought came to me, what in the world could I do with those, with that family? And so the Union Pacific maintained a big storeroom. Oh, it was about 40 foot square. And it had steam heat in it, set right down close to the boiler room. Mm-hmm. And it was an emergency supply room.
I see.
And it had everything in there imaginable for supplies. Beds and cushions, caboose cushions, which are about 4 foot thick, about 4 inches thick. And about 6 to 7 feet long. Mm-hmm. Made a nice bed to sleep on in an emergency. So I says, well, my goodness, now I had a key to it, and the roundhouse foreman, the day roundhouse foreman had a key to it. And that's the only two people in Huntington that had access to this place. And among other things that was in there was 40, 30, 30 Caribbean rifles, and lots of ammunition.
What do they need those for, eh?
Well, I expect they've had them in there in the days of the Indians, and but the Indians were gone now, and they just left them there. And there was lots of canned goods in there, canned beans and various things like that, and soups, and whatnot, just emergency rations, mm-hmm. crackers and stuff. And the eatables were usually changed out every year in there to have fresher stuff. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, my goodness, I've got to do something with this little family. So it came to my mind just quick as a flash. I'm going to move them in there even if I get fired. And which I fully expected to do if... they found out what went on. But I thought I'd plead my case if it came to that. So I took it upon myself to get this little family up, and there were six little children. The oldest one, I think, was 11, and the baby was about 6 or 7 months. That's the one that was crying. And all in the world they had in there was a half a bottle of milk, frozen solid as ice, and part of a loaf of bread. So I told that man, I said, you come with me now, let's gather up here. And it was just, oh, maybe 50 yards to this building where we had this emergency supply. And I put him in there, and I knew nobody else could get in there but me and the day foreman. And the day foreman was W.C. Johnson. The little red-headed fellow was a fine man in Huntington. So I put them in there, and that poor little baby was just about blue. It was so cold. And the little kids all had their nose running. They were so cold, and it was just covered with coal dust, and it was a pitiful sight to behold. Now, in this building, we didn't have any bathtubs, but we had a nice big washbowl and toilet facilities in there. And so I took this family and I put them in the emergency supply room. And they were all hungry and crying and whimpering. So I went across then to the restaurant. I didn't want them to go across or expose to anybody that they were in this building. And I got, maybe a gallon and a half of big soup, a good thick soup, hot soup, and a big box of crackers. There were all the dishes they wanted to use in the world right in the building. And I got 4 quarts of milk and I think 7 or 8 hamburgers. Hamburgers at that time, believe it or not, cost us 10 cents a piece. And milk, I think, was 8 cents a quart. And we always got a generous supply from this restaurant here who was kind of appreciated what the railroad men were doing. But they use unfortunate people.
Oh. Thank God, Dad. What happened then? Did they stay in that building? Well, you got fed up with some hot soup in a way, Dad, huh?
Yeah. You ready to go?
Yeah.
Well, I told this fella and his wife now to stay right in here and not get out. And they could keep it just as warm as they wanted to in this building. But I didn't want them to go out roaming around or open any doors and to be quiet in there as possible. But you see, the next day was Saturday. This was a Friday night. And there'd be nobody in the storeroom. The storeroom was part of this building. And it was closed up with the exception of W.C. Johnson and me, who had a key to the regular locomotive supply room.
Mm-hmm.
And the storekeeper did not work on Saturday. But if we wanted anything, we could go in and get it and leave a requisition for it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, towards morning, I went over and got another gallon of milk and a dozen hamburgers and a big box of cookies and a dozen Hershey bars. And brought over, and I figured they could pass that out because I told them that the Union Pacific wouldn't miss a can of beans or two if they could warm on the radiator there if they wanted to. And there's some soups there too. So the next day was Saturday. So when I come to work, why, after I got rid of the day roundhouse foreman, however, I had told him that I didn't want him to go in that room that day. I told him in 2 or 3 days I'd tell him the story, which I did. And he said, well, fine. He said that was good enough for him. So I went in then Saturday evening. And boy, all those little kids was all cleaned up, just as slick and whistle as you could see. And the mother and father were cleaned up. And it was a beautiful, beautiful family, Merrill. Just, you can't imagine what the difference of getting out of that boxcar covered with coal dust and 10 below zero and the wind blowing, what a difference it made for those little kids to get in there and get their bellies full of good warm food and into a good warm place.
Where did they come from, Dad? Did they tell you?
They came from Ohio.
Is that right?
Yeah. But they happened to get in the worst blizzard that we had ever witnessed in Huntington.
Hmm.
And the coldest one. Anyway, why, when Senator King come in that night, now Senator King was an engineer. I think I previously mentioned that. But he would collect this money and turn it over to me, and then, well, there was 15 or 20 of them around Huntington that would give me 50 cents or a quarter. And we didn't give these people the money, as I mentioned, because we thought they'd maybe go buy a beer with it or something else.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted them to have good warm food, which we thought was the right thing to do.
Right.
Well, anyway, Senator King and I sat and discussed it for quite a little bit in the office, and I think I had $17 left in our kitty. I kept track of everything I spent and everything. Senator King and I would talk it over. He was a wonderful man. They call him Senator King. I can't remember his first name, William C. or something like that, but he was a... he had previously been a senator in the state of Idaho.
Hmm.
But he was an engineer also on the Union Pacific Railroad. And when he was elected to the Senate in Idaho, why, he still...
Concluding. Here are a few concluding notes on my generation. I attended elementary and high school in La Grande, Oregon, except for my last year of grade school and the first and part of the second year of high school in Huntington, Oregon. My dad was transferred there from his post in La Grande during the Depression years by the Union Pacific Railroad. His supervisory post at La Grande was eliminated because of the Depression, and he went to Huntington as the night foreman of the Union Pacific Maintenance Division point there. On CD number 2, he relates an interesting story of the winter conditions there during the Depression years. I picked out my wife-to-be, Betty Lee Burns, during my junior year in high school at La Grande. At a high school basketball game, I bet my friend, Henry Stoddard, 25 cents that I could take her home from the game. I won the bet, and my wife of now over 60 years. Betty and I went our separate ways for advanced schooling, but kept continually in touch. After I finished with my engineering degree, I returned to La Grande to claim Betty as my bride. I thought then, and I think now, that this was probably the best decision of my life. My college grades were such that I was fortunate in being selected by the Douglas Aircraft Company, headquartered in Santa Monica, California, as a participant in a program for graduate engineers they call Department 66. This program transferred an engineer from one department to another throughout the company each week or two for a year without really expecting them to be very productive. This provided the young engineer with a great and well-rounded exposure and much experience, really, in aircraft engineering and manufacturing. I was able to find a nice studio apartment in Santa Monica for $25 a month out of my principally $26.44 weekly engineering take-home pay. I met Betty at the railroad station one rainy evening in Glendale, took her out to dinner, and to our new home in Santa Monica. World War II was about to begin, and at Douglas we were building aircraft being flown directly to Britain under a lend-lease agreement negotiated by our President and Congress to support a beleaguered Great Britain, as the United States was not yet in the war. A second night job at the Interstate Aircraft Corporation in El Segundo, plus extra pay for overtime work on special assignments at Douglas, let us accumulate enough funds to move from our apartment to a rental house, and then with the birth of our Michael, to buy a home. Our home at 11217 Graham Place in West Los Angeles was purchased through William Hyler, who with his brother Grover were prominent real estate brokers and real estate developers. Bill was to become our friend and my mentor for the rest of his life. The house was a beautiful two-bedroom home with hand-pegged oak floors throughout, fireplace, big lot, and in a lovely neighborhood. The purchase price was $4,500. On a visit to the area many years later, we found that not only the house, but the entire neighborhood was sacrificed to a freeway interchange. World War II intervened. At the time of Pearl Harbor, we had not yet moved into our new home and were living in a rental house about two blocks from the east end of the main runway at the airport where the Douglas Aircraft Company was located. Barrage balloon companies and anti-aircraft batteries were rushed in from the Midwest, and we were personally enveloped in a maze of barrage balloon defenses, anti-aircraft batteries, and camouflage structures for the Douglas facilities. There, at this rental home, we listened to the fireside chats from Franklin Delano Roosevelt by radio, observed blackout regulations and air raid drills, and experienced the infamous scare-generated Japanese air raid on the Douglas plant. Anti-aircraft firing fallback was coming down like rain. The location of the aircraft, quote, shot down by our anti-aircraft fire, as reported in newspapers the next morning, was a couple of miles from our house. I volunteered for Navy service in preference to being drafted, and for the opportunity to receive engineering graduate training in aircraft electronics. The importance of electronics, formerly just radio, in war was just being realized with the invention of radar, radio direction finding, electronic navigation, and communications. The Navy was establishing a large program to educate engineers from other fields in the field of electronics. I was fortunate, after passing successive examinations, to qualify and be selected for this program. We gave Bill Hyler power of attorney to take care of our new home. I put Betty and Michael on the train for La Grande, Oregon, and got on a train myself for Chicago and the Great Lakes Naval Training Station. After Navy boot camp, I came back to Chicago for training in general electrical basics and electronics. After graduation there, I was reassigned to Texas A&M at College Station, Texas, for graduate work in aircraft electronics design and operations. Betty left her temporary job in the health department in La Grande and joined me later in College Station. There she worked as a secretary in the agronomy department at the college. A weekly foray into Bryan, Texas for dinner and a movie was our highlight of the week. On completion of my graduate work at Texas A&M, I was assigned to duty at the Corpus Christi Naval Air Station main base. Betty went to La Grande and brought back Michael from my parents who had been caring for him. Here, after a short while, we procured a nice small apartment, being vacated fortuitously by old friends from La Grande. Navy Chief Dick Walker and his wife were being reassigned shortly after we arrived. My duty there at the base consisted of design and performance of modifications on aircraft that were being transflown from Britain via Corpus Christi for rework to the South Pacific for service there, as the war was beginning to wind down in Europe. My next assignment was transferred to the San Diego North Island Naval Air Station. We drove across the country after a false start and returned to Corpus Christi in a defunct, newly purchased, too well-used car. A swap for a black Studebaker got us going again. 4 days of my 10-day delayed order transfer, and we were still moving through the Texas Panhandle. Duty in San Diego was similar to that in Corpus, with the exception of being on flight pay and on flight duty for test work and patrol duty south to the Galapagos. Available naval housing was abominable, so we purchased a nice house on Poinsettia Avenue in Loma Portal, and I was able to be off base during my off-duty hours. I set up a radio repair shop in our garage, and in my spare time did radio repair work for local radio and appliance stores. Betty got work as a Western Union communicator and deliverer and was able to work from the house and care for Michael. Betty liked this work, except for the miserable responsibility of relaying telegrams from the military, reporting deaths and missing in action cases to local San Diego families. Except for a brief transfer to the aircraft carrier Essex for discharge duty in San Francisco at war's end, this concluded our military duty. Back in West Los Angeles, Bill Heiler had, at our request, sold our home at a nice profit at a point earlier when we didn't know when or if we would be returning. Now he had a nice apartment waiting for us, and we were ready to return after selling our home in Loma Portal. On a trip to Van Nuys from San Diego, visiting an old school friend, Bob Burke, and his family, I located and purchased acreage in Northridge, where we would later build a home. My work at Douglas had disappeared at war's end, and after taking on other less than satisfactory assignments there, I moved to the research and development facility of the Bendix Corporation in North Hollywood. We moved from the apartment Bill had procured for us and into a large investment property in Cheviot Hills, which he was holding for renovation and resale. Betty, working with an architect, designed the home we immediately started building on the property in Northridge. This was to be a nice rural commute from my new work location in North Hollywood. Here at Bendix were accumulated some years of great experience with great people. During these years, I had the opportunity to mature professionally, participate in, and then head a series of interesting and challenging activities. Other than the fact that considerable travel was involved, and this kept me from home too much, the professional exposure was ideal and kept me at the cutting edge of fast-moving technology. Post-war developments were many in electronics, with the Korean War, Vietnam, Sputniks, and the space race all escalating the tempo. I was retained as a consultant by the U.S. Navy Research and Development Board, and for a year chaired their committee on electronic miniaturization. During these years, I was able to personally develop two other ventures. The first was a magnetic door lock, which was premature and was a financial flop. I had developed it for potential sale, but by what was then Sears Roebuck. Upon completion, the manufacturing cost was too high, and Sears didn't think they could sell it profitably in competition with their lines of traditional mechanical locks. However, it was the forerunner of the magnetic key cards that open doors and gates everywhere today. I then developed an electrochemical destaticizer, which we trade named Electrosol. After introducing the development by presenting a paper at a meeting of the Society of Chemical Engineers in Cincinnati, the product found a ready market in removing the electrostatic charge from things from carpeting to phonograph records, and interestingly, to rotating cylinder action lamps, which were then very popular. The product was compounded in large cases and large kettles in our kitchen in Northridge, and shipped in cases of gallon jugs everywhere. With funds accruing from this source, we were ready to try something a little larger. We had started the Circon Component Company in Northridge, California, in our home and garage, and a second garage which we built specifically for the purpose in early 1954. In 1955, we began looking for the best place to move the business, and after numerous visits, settled on Santa Barbara, California. We negotiated leases with Bill Hyler's help with the city of Santa Barbara for three buildings at the Santa Barbara Airport, where we began operations on the 1st of January in 1956. The negotiated lease provided renewal options for a period of 20 years and an option to lease a fourth building if it were ever vacated. This lease was a valuable resource as we grew and industrial rental rates escalated over the coming years. I was requested and was granted an indefinite leave of absence from my affiliation at Bendix. We operated an electronic research and development facility at Circon, which was supported financially by manufacture and sale of the products we developed. The name Circon we derived from the words circuit and connector, which were the first products that we designed and produced. Incorporation soon followed, and the Circon Corporation still functions successfully in new buildings in Goleta, California, 46 years after its Northridge beginnings. We sold the business in 1970, and I concluded a 12-month management contract in 1971. During my concluding months at Circon, I supervised construction of an office, shop, library, and working lab building on our home property in Santa Barbara. Here I have kept occupied, pursuing my many interests since that time, and here I am recording these notes in conclusion of this family record. May God be with you, listener. And with subsequent generations of this Ainsworth family.